Pope is the thing with feathers.
Pope is the thing with feathers.
That's like a bird.
Like a bird.
That perches in the soul.
That perches in the soul. Welcome to the Thing with Feathers podcast, a podcast about birds and hope. I'm your host, birding enthusiast, Courtney Ellis. Welcome back to the Thing with Feathers podcast. So glad you're here with us today as we welcome a fabulous guest. Emma Rhodes is an avian biologist and a PhD candidate at Auburn University. She studies the physiological underpinnings of avian migration. She's also a bird bander, and she and her partner Kyle cooperate an all-volunteer operated nonprofit banding coalition of the Americas. I'm so excited to learn from Emma today. Emma, welcome to the pod.
Thanks for having me, Courtney. I'm excited to be here.
It is so good to have you here. Migration is magic.
Yes, it is.
It is. And you're a scientist.
Absolutely. But I mean, you can definitely straddle both sides. And I think that, you know, just because I'm a scientist doesn't make it any less magical.
Well, tell us some of the wonders of migration. You're studying this in a really, really deep way that those of us who just log on to Birdcast to watch the nightly migration or see a new bird in our yard can only begin to scratch the surface. Tell us about the wonders of migration and your particular area of study.
Well, I think to start with, I think we should mention how long migration has been this event that has made people wonder about it for millennia. So, you know, you have people like Aristotle, and then during the medieval period, we have these crazy theories of, you know, people noticed that these birds on a seasonal basis would disappear. And so they came up with these myths and legends about like fishermen finding this ball of swallows in their fishing nets and birds flying to the moon. And so what's fascinating to me is while these were not correct, as we began to uncover the mysteries of migration, it seems as if it's almost just as magical, even though now we understand more of the scientific backing. And that's really where my passion lies, is because I really want to understand this this amazing feat that these birds undergo yearly. I mean, we have species that travel hundreds of thousands of miles twice a year. You know, you have something like the barred-tailed godwit that for 11 days straight can fly upwards of 11,000 kilometers. I mean, to give you perspective of that, that's a like 11-day, you know, again, it's like 11-day nonstop flight from New Zealand to Alaska and back. And so you have these crazy, like, ultra marathon runners that are birds without the training. And so I tell people, it's like, if you, or if it's like, if I woke up one day, no, you know, I'm not a sports person, not a training, you know, Olympic runner. And I woke up one day and all of a sudden I was an Olympic runner. And most people know that takes a whole lifetime of conditioning and training and muscle building. And but these birds are able to do these things and undergo these changes without exercise, but on a hormonal and genetic level and a molecular level to essentially change their physiology. So they become a totally different bird before migration, and then it all reverses back when they get to their winter ground. So it's pretty amazing.
It's mind blowing. How do birds fly for days on end? That feels impossible.
Impossible, right? Well, the thing is again, I think the thing to stress on is that their physiology changes prior to migration. And so what happens is, the trigger is photoperiod. So if a bird, well, so first of all, I should mention if a bird is going to migrate or not, like whether or not it's a bird like a Carolina wren that doesn't migrate, or maybe a indigo bunting that migrates, that is predetermined based on the bird's genetics. So when it is born, it has all that information it needs to determine whether or not it's going to migrate. And prior to migration, what happens is a photoperiod triggers this suite of changes. Again, it's on a hormonal and a molecular level that tells certain things to turn on and off. And so what we see is we have things like where the birds will all of a sudden start eating a whole lot. So it's something we call hyperphagy. So they just start consuming as much food as they can, a lot of nutrient dense and omega fatty acid dense foods, and they start packing on the pounds, not just with fat, but with muscle too. And so we have species like the gray catbird that we know enlarge their pectoralis, that's their chest or breast muscle, as much as like 40% before migration. So like you can imagine like it's like that would be huge for an athlete to have that type of muscle increase. And so they pack on these pounds. And there's these other things that are going on, of course, that allow them to migrate. But when they do these nonstop flights, they have essentially created enough nutrients in their body that's all they need. They can fast, and that fat and muscle will break down to where the output is energy. And fat's really important because fat is very water dense, and unlike us humans, they can use that almost directly as a fuel source, and while also keeping their hydration status, because as you can imagine, that's really important too. Same with athletes, to maintain your hydration status. And so there's a lot going on there, but that's just the underlying things going on, is that they can essentially fast. And what we see is when birds complete their migration, all that muscle and fat will be burned up. Not all of it, but a lot of it. And so that's how we can kind of tell whether or not a bird is on the end or the beginning of their migratory path.
How do they sleep?
I should say that, like in the case of the bar-tailed godwit, I don't know for sure if they have looked at this, but we know that birds in some species, we have shown that they can do sleeping on the wing, where part of their brain shuts off, and it's called semi-hemispheric sleep or something like that. And essentially, so don't quote me on that because it's been a while since I read about that. But I'm not sure. I think with the bar-tailed godwit, I don't know if we've demonstrated that, but I could imagine that's probably similar. Because people have done this and shown this on seabirds that never land, like albatrosses that never land for long periods of time. Now with like songbirds, they're probably going to fly nonstop upwards of 17 to 24 hours. So they're probably just, my bet would be they're just not sleeping. So that's just, a long stretch that they just continue until they're done. And that's why stopover habitat's so important, because it gives them these resting places along their migratory pathways. But yeah, that's an excellent question. But that's probably what's going on with things like the bar-tailed godwit, is they're probably sleeping. Half of their brain is off while the other half is active, and they can swap sides and they're able to sleep like that. So not something we can do.
It's astonishing. I wish we could. Yeah. I would get so much more housework done. Our house would actually be clean for once if right. I could just autopilot it.
It would be helpful if we could turn half of our brain off and still do the minimum functions. And yeah, that would be very helpful.
It's so fascinating. They're such wondrous creatures. And so we're in the month of May, and you're down there in Alabama. What are you seeing migration-wise in Alabama this time of year?
So we already actually have birds that are set up on territory. So the past couple of weeks, we had our migration is peaks around the first and second week of April along the northern Gulf Coast, so along the Alabama coastline. And so now things like water thrushes, indigo buntings, catbirds, yellow-breasted chats. I've been seeing them already setting up territory in Auburn, Alabama. Tanagers, so we have summer tanagers that are already on territory. And I actually was just listening outside this morning, and I usually have in my neighborhood wood thrush and wood thrush breeding around here and a summer tanager, but I heard a Swainson's warbler. So I was like, maybe he's going to set up in the backyard. That would be pretty cool, or nearby. So that's a really good bird to hear.
It's a very hard question to ask someone who's in a field such as yourself, but do you have a favorite bird?
So my favorite for Alabama, I'll stick to that, is the American Red Start. And because I get that question a lot on these, when I talk to people and when I do these sort of things. And the reason being is they're very near and dear to my heart, because where we band along the coast in Alabama, particularly Fort Morgan, our public site, I always associate them with that site because there's always an American Red Star just being very quiet, jumping through and trying to scare off insects, like just fanning its tail and jumping up and down in the habitat. And to me, too, they remind me of fall and Halloween. So, and we see lots of them in the fall when we're banding there in Fort Morgan, and the males just are just that brilliant black and just stark orange. And it's a Halloween bird. I mean, that's just how, you know, what it is. So, and I always enjoy getting, I go up to Maine every summer and teach at the Hog Island Audubon Camp for teens. And then I get to see them, you know, also there actively breeding and singing, and they're quite dense there. And so, I'm really partial to them. They're just a cool little warbler. And if anyone doesn't know listening, it's a wood warbler, so a smaller songbird that eats insects. And it's an Eastern U.S. breeder.
Yeah, we don't get those out here in Southern California. I need to make a pilgrimage.
No, yeah, you don't get those.
Well, let's talk bird banding for a little bit, because you manage this all-volunteer bird banding station. And, you know, I work at a church and we manage a lot of volunteers, and they're amazing. And it's a little bit like herding cats. Working with volunteers is its own thing. So how do you manage an all-volunteer-based bird banding station? What have you learned?
Yeah, it's always a learning process. And, you know, this was something that, so Kyle and I had luckily seen and learned how to run a station properly from our mentors, because our mentors ran also this all volunteer operated nonprofit called the Hummerbird Study Group. And it was, they were based out of Birmingham, Alabama, and they ran the Fort Morgan site publicly for nearly 30 years. And funny story, Kyle and I actually met there as teenagers, because we were the only teens that, you know, and it was the gap of ages was very wide. You know, it was mainly retirees, and then it was Emma and Kyle. And I started when I was 14, and he started when he was 16 there. And we trained at this public site. So not only did we learn banding from an early age, but we learned the do's and don'ts of public banding and how the volunteer crew has to mesh and work together. And so, it wasn't something we planned. We essentially just got more and more into our own projects. And we were like, well, I mean, we want to do this work, but we have to have a way to fund it. And at the time, this was in 2020, I had just got accepted into graduate school at Auburn, and Kyle just started his own construction business. And we were like, we are crazy for trying to do this. And, you know, but it was just obvious. It was what we wanted to do. And, the funny thing was, too, it was just such a weird time to be doing it, like 2020, like mid-pandemic, prime of pandemic. And so we essentially did some pilot efforts. And then in 2021, that was when we really hit the ground running and did our first fully operational public banding, like the sergeants did at Fort Morgan, and, you know, a full crew. So we could have anywhere from 10 to 15 crew members. And thankfully, you know, with our help of our supporters and funders, you know, we're able to house those volunteers, because, you know, they're taking their precious vacation time, time away from work, time away from their families. And so we at least, you know, house them, and they help us for the entire 8.5 days. And it's a big ordeal because not only do we have high density of birds there, we can have upwards to 600 to 800 people in those 8.5 days. Yeah. So you also have the people management. And our thing too is when we are there, we're not just scientists, we're also educators. And that was something that our mentors, Bob and Martha Sargent, really instilled on us was, you know, if you're doing research, great. But if you want to talk to the public, you have to know, you know, how to talk to them and how to reach them on their level in a way that they understand, which I think is super important because otherwise they're not going to understand why we do research and why we ban birds. And so, yeah, it's a huge, I have to say, I'm still learning. Kyle and I, we tag team it and we have a great group of people now that, you know, we're starting to get our core group that comes every year. And then we get a few banders who, you know, want to visit and see how we operate. And it's always a learning process. But I have to say, I feel really lucky that we have such a great group of banders from all different backgrounds. You know, you were talking about, you know, earlier to me how you were just an enthusiast. I mean, some of these people are just bird enthusiasts. Some of them have a degree. Some of them don't. You know, like with me, I'm an academic. But Kyle, my partner, he didn't take the academic route. And but he knows just as much about birds as myself, I would say. So yeah, it's a learning process. I'm always learning more every season.
I think that's one of the things I appreciate most about birding is whatever angle you use to approach birding teaches you something unique. So I think scientists know so much about birds, but poets know different things about birds. And yeah, someone who owns a construction business is going to approach birds in a different way, and we need each other. And now I'm going to be fantasizing about coming to bird banding summer camp with you guys because that sounds amazing. Spring camp.
You should come. Yeah, you should come to, the next banding will be banding at Fort Morgan in the first week of October. And on the coast of Alabama. So you could come this fall if you wanted to and actually see this in person.
Important question, Emma. Are the mosquitoes dead in October?
I hate to tell you this. No. We always, on our Fort Morgan list on our website of what you should bring, it includes mosquito spray. Now, we have ways of trying to keep them at a minimum around the banding area when they just get so bad that you just, you know, it's just impossible. And I'll tell you, some falls are just worse than others. It's really variable. It just depends on how much rain we've had prior to the banding event. Last fall, we got really lucky because it was really dry all the weeks prior. And so the mosquitoes were pretty, you know, bare minimum. But we've had years where it's pretty bad. I'm not going to lie. But again, we try to deter them, at least from the banding area.
I think you southern birders and southeastern birders are, as a general rule, hardier than the Southern California birders. You know, we go out and there are a couple of flies out and we're like, oh, can't handle it. So you guys are tougher than we are. I'm just going to lay it out there. It's true. So what are you learning at the banding station? What are you learning about these birds that you're banding year after year?
So what's interesting is to see how just in mine and Kyle's time doing this, how migration has shifted. I mean, this is all anecdotal, just our own observations. But definitely him and I agree that we see some differences, particularly with the number of birds. And, you know, one of the things that why we're doing this is we want to keep building on this new data set to compare to the historical data. And that's going to take some time. Like I mentioned, we, you know, just really launch this, you know, around 2020. And so it's going to take us some time to be able to really get at that question. And that's the whole point, is to constantly go out, you know, every year around the same time and then get a snapshot of migration. And we're hoping, you know, with that, we can actually learn more. And I mean, the thing is the other aspect of this is advocacy for that site. So along Alabama coast, similar to Florida and other coastal areas, you know, these habitats are in, this land is in high demand for development. And, you know, there's not much habitat left. And so what we do have, we want to conserve and to remind people why we're conserving it and why we're not, you know, necessarily like making it into a condo and trying to make money off of it. Because, you know, if like a site like Fort Morgan, it's like if that disappeared, you know, this is a maritime habitat. So you can imagine like a piney, sandy habitat, brush habitat. And it's on the very end of a 30-mile peninsula. Most of that peninsula is developed. Thankfully, we have refuge property and the Fort Morgan historic site, which has done a great job of having the habitat and the tourism aspect of the actual fort. But and that's the other aspect that makes it kind of unique is that you have a whole entire fort there that, you know, was used during both World War One and Two. And so there's all this history there. And actually where we banned is called the stables because that was where the horses were kept. So it's also very historic. You know, we just want to advocate for like why, you know, we can do this in a way where, you know, the birding and banding is benefiting tourism. Like it is its own income. Like it makes its own income, and we want to make people aware of like what is there, because a lot of people just have never seen any of these birds in their entire lives. And so like a painted bunting, it's like so many people will see a painted bunting, an indigo bunting, and be like, how is that thing even, you know, in existence? And so we just want them to leave the site thinking about that, like this, okay, this is really important so that my kids can see and future generations can see these birds. And so that the birds won't lose that critical habitat. Hmm.
Emma, will you tell us a little bit about your own journey into birding? Have you always been a birder? Now you're clearly all in. Have you always been all in?
Yeah, I have. I would say generally, so I was always an outdoorsy kid. And I kind of just happened upon birds. Like they weren't really introduced to me. I just was like, oh, I wonder what these birds are called. Like, I just wanted to know. And so I kind of self-started by just finding books at my local library that gave me information on like what ornithology is and, you know, and what banding is. And, you know, I was like, oh, wow, like, I want to be an ornithologist. And of course, like any parent would, my parents thought it was just a phase and it never went away. So since about 7 years old, I was 7 years old, I've been a birder. And so I started just doing backyard birding, attracting the birds in my backyard. And then when I was 12, I went to something called the Alabama Coastal Bird Fest, which happens every fall in coastal Alabama. And I took a trip with my father that went to Fort Morgan to see the banding. And that's when I originally met the sergeants and the Hummingbird Study Group. Now, I didn't start getting involved in terms of training to band until 2 years later. But that was really what I think drove me to the trajectory that I've been on in terms of my career and my passions. Was once I got into that, applying all this passion I had for birds into banding, that was it. Like I was hooked. I was like, okay, this is what I want to do. And I want to do science. And I wasn't really sure at first how I was going to make money, because that's always a question. My parents weren't sure either. And so I started with just, okay, well, I'll just get a biology degree in undergrad, and then I'll learn, you know, some skills that, you know, do hopefully make some money, like something called GIS. Like I have a minor in geographic information systems, which is a mapping analysis tool that can be used broadly in both science and business. And then I took about 2.5 years and worked for a nonprofit as a coastal biologist in Alabama. And then I really wanted to go back, though, I want to contribute to the greater knowledge of bird migration and find essentially how to hopefully make a career out of this. And so that's when I went back to PhD school at Auburn, because not only am I, it would allow me to pursue my passion while also obtaining skills that are in high demand, like laboratory skills that, hopefully would give me options for a job. And so that's kind of, been my trajectory. I've just kind of been flexible and, had to learn what I did and didn't want to do, like anyone. I did some field jobs and kind of that gave me enough experience to figure out maybe I want to go into this, and maybe I, don't want to necessarily do temporary field jobs every single season. Maybe I want something a little more permanent, like being a professor and teaching and doing research. But yeah, that's my story.
I love when I hear from people about a passion that started in childhood and they stuck with it. Cause I think, I'm a parent, I have 3 young kids, and we kind of think, he's not going to want to be a firefighter forever, but some people do. And to cling to that childhood passion, I wrote since I could hold a pencil, and now I write books, as my hobby, really. It does not pay the bills, but it's a lot of fun. And I think sometimes we learn a lot from that childhood passion, and you don't have to let it go necessarily. There can be a living in birds.
And I think the name of the game is to be flexible, because I don't make money off of banding birds, and I tell people that I had to be flexible in that. It's like, okay, I'm going to do science, and now I'm going to get into the technicality of that, of being able to do analyses and obtain grants and write papers. And, sure, maybe it's not as fun as being out in the woods and banding, but it pays the bills. And so I think that's the thing, is that I feel lucky in that I've been able to have that flexibility of, all right, well, what can I do that is still getting at my goal and it will allow me to do these things that I want to do and contribute to, science. And so, yeah, I feel really lucky in that case. And yeah, I think that's the thing is you just kind of have to figure out what your niche is going to be, like how you're going to be able to have enough time and also like your job enough, right? Like, cause I think that's important.
And the work can be full on birding, or it can be bird adjacent in ways that still give you joy and allow you to contribute in these ways to the larger scientific conversation. And as you mentioned, I sent out a little questionnaire before the podcast, and you mentioned in there, there's just still so much we don't know and understand about migration. So there's work to be done. There's important work to be done, and to be able to contribute to that is what a gift.
I know. Yeah, exactly. Like there's a lot that we don't understand. We've sort of focused on the physiology aspect because that's my background, but there's this navigational and orientation aspect of migration that we don't understand. Not to even mention, this is the craziest thing about it, is migration, it's not like if we looked on an evolutionary tree or how lineages of birds essentially are related to one another. That's what we're talking about. It's not like this one migratory bird emerged, and then from that, all migration strategies happen. Like, it's really crazy when we look at the data, and we haven't totally resolved this in bird families, but how quickly migration has just turned on and off and has just appeared out of nowhere in some cases in these bird lineages. And again, there's still some debate about how this came about, but that's really quite fascinating, because when we talk about, in the birding world, you might hear about some debate about, like, do we split a species into two species, or is it one species? And I mean, for birds, generally, I mean, we're looking at, you know, 1 million years. Of course, you know, this is just, again, from the evolutionary perspective of what generally the science community says that it takes about that long for one species to become two. Again, it depends on what sort of things you follow, as well as in even within our science groups, it depends on what you define as a species, and there's still debate about that. But with migration, you see these groups where they become migratory when they were originally non-migratory, or vice versa, in much less time, like maybe 100,000 years or less. And so that is kind of crazy when it takes a longer time, you know, for them to become a species. It's like, all right, well, how is this happening? Like, how can such a complex trait, you know, switch on and off like that very quickly? Again, we've talked about the physiology, the navigation. These are very complex things. And so I think that's fascinating. You know, no matter what train of a belief, or in terms of your hypotheses and theories that you believe in biology, no matter what, we can all agree that it's complicated and we don't understand it yet. So that's, I think that is really, really cool.
That's so cool. I love thinking, when is the first Carolina wren going to think, okay, I'm migrating. Like, I'm going to be like, one bird has to be first, you know, like one bird that used to not migrate is the first. And I assume they, you know, it's not just a single bird that goes, more would go, but what happens? And is it 1 mile and then it's 3 miles and then it's 10 miles. Last summer we went to the Channel Islands, to Santa Cruz Island, to see the island scrub jay, which only lives on Santa Cruz Island, which is so funny because it's 8 miles from the mainland. So many birds, right? No problem getting to the mainland, but the island scrub jay is like, nope, I don't migrate. I'm here. I'm on this tiny little island and nowhere else. It's so fascinating to me. It's just a bottomless bowl of interest.
Well, yeah. And with islands, it's like, well, you know, like with that, it's like an individual had to get there and then stayed there and was isolated. And that's generally what most scientists agree on, that is the most prominent way something becomes a new species, is what we call, you know, reproductive isolation. So they get isolated from the rest of the population. And just by chance, random chance, they start to become something new, right? Like their genetics change just by chance, because they are not interbreeding with that other parent population. Over time, they eventually just become their own unique thing, even if they look the same. And that's the case with a lot of island birds, actually, is they look very similar to mainland birds, like you're talking about, these endemic island birds, but they actually, through time, have become their own species, and we can see that through genetics. And with a lot of North American birds, I think that the general agreement is that our current migration strategies that we have with our North American birds happened during the last glaciation event. So as glaciers receded, birds had to move based on food availability. So you can just imagine this is going to cause that seasonal pattern to occur. And now, how exactly? Like, again, we can't agree on. There's papers that are in support of, okay, these lineages of birds originally came from the tropics and then they came to North America. Or these came from North America and then they went to the tropics. And so there's a lot of debate still that we haven't totally sorted yet.
I think there can be this perception, especially, you know, I serve a church, and especially within the faith community, that science is kind of a monolith and the story is clear and the agreements are total, but that's not true of any community. And the more we learn, the more some of these things become clear, but also, you know, the disagreements are so interesting. Why do you think it started in North America, or why do you think it started in this way? And I think we can learn a lot from the disagreements as well.
I think a lot of people, I think that's where a lot of confusion comes from about science and misconceptions, is that it's a learning process. And we essentially take the data that we have And sometimes we get new data that disproves the old data. And we're just, it's just building on itself. And that's why, you know, we have the process of a hypothesis, and then the hypothesis is not, you know, it, through time might actually become, you know, a theory, or, you know, vice versa. Like, we're, it's not necessarily, it's not necessarily truth. Like, we're trying to figure that out. And no matter what, like, whether or not our hypothesis is incorrect or correct, it's going to tell us something about the natural world. And yeah, I think it's important to mention that, because, you know, we weren't there when it happened. And so we are just using the information we have and trying to, in an unbiased way, say, well, based on this information, what is most likely that happened? And it builds on itself, you know, and that's exactly right. Like, and that's important to keep in mind. Like, we scientists don't necessarily agree what a species is. Like, that's the one thing you learn when you're in getting a biology degree, is that we have all these species concepts. And like, what makes a species? You know, if you have two birds that look different, but their genetic information is 99% the same, what is that? Are they different color morphs? So like different versions of the same bird, or are they species? And so this gets really complicated. And I think it's, yeah, definitely great to share with people who are not from that background of, this is why sometimes it's hard to share that without there being misconceptions, because we're constantly having to update as we're constantly getting this new stream of information.
And what a good thing to model that we're continuing to learn, you know, that it's not a closed door. It's not a closed issue. I have a friend who is an ER doctor, and every once in a while, someone will come into the ER and say, well, but the doctor told me 2 years ago that this was the best medication. And he says, well, science keeps learning. Isn't that good? Isn't that good news? You know, we tell you the best information we know at the time, but we're continuing to learn. And I think that's a beautiful thing. That's what we're trying to teach our kids. So why would we model anything different?
Well, and there wouldn't be a place for me or any scientist if we knew it all. That's the thing, and that's what I tell people, is it's like, that's why we're here, because we don't know it all. I mean, we just don't. There's a lot that we do not understand and that we're trying to get at, and that we're having to show, okay, well, that was wrong, and now we got to update it. So yeah, I think it is really important to talk about that. We definitely do not. It's like, the more I get into this career every year, it's like the less and less I feel like I know. And it is so true. It's like, the more you know, the less you know. Like, it's just like crazy just how much information that we just haven't, we've just barely scratched the surface in science.
So Emma, the show is all about birds, but it's also all about hope. So I'd love to close with one of our standard questions on the show, which is, where are you finding hope these days? And that can be as broadly as you'd like to answer it. So within your field, outside of your field, in your personal life, in your work life, where are you finding hope?
Personally, I find a lot of hope through birds, and sharing the gift of birds with the future generations. So the younger generations, and that's always been really key for me, is, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I love contributing to science, but there is definitely this like emotional connection with being able to allow someone to release a bird. And sometimes we're able to do that. And occasionally, you know, many times when you allow a kid to do this, like, you know, like, you can see where it's just changed them. Like, you can immediately see that there's this light bulb that goes off in their head, where it's like they've made that connection with that bird, and they have a better understanding of, you know, what a bird is and that it exists in this habitat. And to me, that gives me a lot of hope, because, you know, I think that it can be really hard for bird enthusiasts and scientists right now to navigate you know, what's going on with birds, because there's been a lot of just really not, you know, really depressing data coming out in terms of our bird numbers and the decline. You know, migratory birds are in decline. And and like I have always, that's what I go back on, because, you know, it's so important to keep up the good work, right? Because of that. And so I always try to focus on that, as seeing these, you know, new generations coming up and being able to make them advocates. That gives me hope for the future of, hey, we're going to have people, no matter their background, that can advocate for these habitats and for these birds, and that they're important for us, not again, for our hope, for joy, but for the habitats that we're in, and that they have a role in our environment.
I love that. It's making me think. So there are a couple of local bird banding spots here, just, you know, 10, 12 miles away. And I think our oldest child is 11, and he's probably almost at the age where he could go and help. And that could be a great thing for him as well as for me.
Yeah, he definitely should check it out.
Something about holding a bird in your hand. It's magic.
Yes, 100%.
Well, Emma Rhodes, thank you so much for the gift of your time and your expertise and your wisdom. We wish you well in finishing up that PhD and doing some continued great avian work in the world. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Courtney. And thanks for having me. And I would just say, as a last thing, if anyone wants to come out and see our public banding events, bandingcoalition.org, so BANDING coalition.org. We have our fall dates and information posted. So we'd love to see you guys and see birders or non-birders and nature enthusiasts, anyone, to come out and check it out.
Bring your bug spray.
Yes, bring your bug spray.
I'll link to that in the show notes as well. And I'm putting that on my bucket list of dreams. So
awesome. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Emma. The Thing with Feathers is produced by me, Courtney Ellis. Many thanks to Del Belcher for the music, to Todd Peterson for the name inspiration, and to Emily Dickinson for the beautiful poem and for being in the public domain. Until next time, my friends, keep looking up.
What does it go in your soul? Yes, it does.